America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at hollywoodblends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a popular actor and singer who's been dazzling the world of stage and screen with his remarkable talent, charisma, and versatility for over four decades. And his talent comes as no surprise, given that he is a member of Hollywood royalty. He's the son of the beloved and legendary entertainers Jack Cassidy and Shirley Jones. His body of work in musical theater is incredibly impressive. On Broadway, he starred in The Pirates of Penzance, Annie Get Your Gun, Aida, 42nd Street, and Leader of the Pack, which earned him a Tony Award nomination for Best Actor. He's also starred in national tours of some of those shows I just mentioned. And in fact, he won the National Broadway Theater Award for Best Actor in a touring musical for his performance in Aida before playing the role on Broadway. He originated the role of the balladeer in the off-Broadway production of Stephen Sondheim's Assassins, and he has starred in numerous other theatrical productions, including The Sound of Music, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, The Robber Bridegroom, Company, and the Threepenny Opera, for which he was nominated for the Garland Award for Best Actor. On the big screen, he's appeared in Off the Wall, Nickel Mountain, Fever Pitch, Love at Stake, Man of Her Dreams, A One-Time Thing, and of course, the brilliant, groundbreaking, Oscar-nominated movie, Longtime Companion. On television, you've seen him in many movies, TV series, and miniseries, including Midnight Offerings, Angel Dusted, Dress Grey, Dirty Dancing, Napoleon and Josephine, Hitler's Daughter, Ruby and the Rockets, and many more. Our guest is also the artistic director of the renowned Studio 10 Theater Company in Franklin, Tennessee. I am delighted and honored to welcome Patrick Cassidy to our show. Patrick, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, Harvey. It can only go down from here based on that introduction. So thank you, Harvey. It's been wonderful. Thank you. It's like overwhelming. It's really overwhelming to hear after one has been so blessed as I have to hear your career and somebody kind of like talk about the things that you've done that like I completely forgot about. And, you know, it's really overwhelming. Thank you so much. What a beautiful intro. Thank you.
Well, it's my great pleasure. I want to start, Patrick, if I may, by paying tribute to your amazing parents, Jack Cassidy and Shirley Jones. Your mom recently turned 90. How is she doing?
She's great. She's incredibly healthy. She lives in California, up in San Ynez, where my brother Sean lives. We moved her up there. She is, incredible healthy 90. She's not traveling anymore, but she is... I speak to her 2-3 times a day and go out to see her at least twice a year if I can. And she is the ultimate of genuineness and positivity and love. Growing up, everybody always said to me, because of the Partridge Family, I want your mom to be my mom. Because remember, she came into everybody's house at 8:30 on Friday nights. And because what she sort of gave is what she is. She is truly that person. Her career, albeit, you know, incredibly successful, was never that important to her. Her family was. Her children are. Her grandchildren now. And so I always thought that she had her priorities in the right place. And she was just gifted with that incredible voice, beautiful, and a naturalness on screen that people fall in love with. But she's really great. Thank you for asking.
Well, please give her my love. Tell her that she is very deeply loved by her millions of fans. I wonder, did your parents ever give you any career advice?
Yeah, don't go into show business.
Did they mean it?
I do believe they did. I mean, I think they both knew the difficulties of it, you know, and I think they tried to convey that to each one of us, starting with David, who's my half brother and my father's son. You know, my father, when he saw David at the pinnacle of his success at Madison Square Garden, he cried because he saw this thing that had been created that wasn't real, you know, and he was right in the sense that after that went away and those teenage girls grew up, it just disappeared. And here was this 19-year-old kid, and you don't know who you are at 19, going, oh, that is who I am. And we know that's not true. And then I think he spent much of his life trying to recapture that, and he never obviously got there. And I think it really wore on him, and I know it did. You know, so they saw what this business can do to you. You have to have an incredibly strong foundation. And what my brother Sean went through it too, in that sort of teen idol thing, and really know yourself and be able to weather the heartache and rejection and all that goes along with it. And that's why I think when I finally decided I'm going to do this, I mean, none of us went to college. And that's just a miracle that we managed to, like, you know, have success in this business. And more importantly, continued success. You know, you can be a flash in the pan. You can have that one shot. But to continue doing it and to work at it and to make a living at it is a really rare thing, I think. And I have the examples of both my brothers of going, oh, okay, that road could be very short. And even shorter being the fact I was the third Cassidy to do this. And I had all those record companies and wanting to sign me and do that. But I moved to New York and wanted to basically, I don't think I made the conscious choice to follow in my father's footsteps, but that's what happened. That's what happened.
Well, you chose musical theater rather than to be a pop star, which ultimately was the right choice in so many ways. I believe you worked with your mom on stage several times in 42nd Street and The Music Man. Mm-hmm. In fact, your mom returned to Broadway after 38 years to be in 42nd Street, and you were in the show with her playing the director, Julian Marsh. That must have been a dream come true for you.
Oh, tremendous. I mean, I'd worked with her a lot. We had done our cabaret acts together, sort of we combined them, and especially later in her career. And we had traveled, done stuff in London, done stuff all over. But yeah, when the thing arose for 42nd Street, well, first of all, it turned out we were the first mother and son to star in a Broadway musical. It had been done in a play with Larry Hagman and Mary Martin, but we were the first to do that. So it got that kind of attention. But yeah, and not just getting to do the show together, which was really a lot of fun, but we lived together. We lived in a duplex and I was on the bottom, she was on the top. And I spent that time in New York with her. And as you said, it had been many years. I mean, the last time was Maggie Flynn with my father in 1960, I think seven or something. So yeah, to have her back in New York and to have her back on Broadway and with me. And I was sort of at that point in my career, you know, I'd been on Broadway five times. So I was kind of, the roles were a little bit reversed. I was showing her, you know, the ropes after all those years of her not being there. I mean, you know, in her day it was sing out, Louise. There weren't microphones. There weren't, you know, it was a different way of, so coming back with all the technology that's involved in putting on a Broadway show, I think it was really exciting for her.
I've heard your mom say in interviews that it was actually your dad who was the best singer and the most talented member of the family. Do you agree with her?
100%.
You do?
My father was an exceptional talent, a rare talent. He had, again, a God-given voice. Gorgeous, gorgeous voice. If you listen to him in early recordings like Wish You Were Here, you hear this incredible tenor, big voice, strong voice, and obviously incredibly handsome, you know, matinee idol looks, much in more, I think, sort of the silent film era, as opposed to, which I think ended up actually hurting him as an actor in the late 60s and 70s in films, because you know, they had moved on. Leading men were much different and more nebbishy and off center a little bit. As he got older, and the tragedy of him before he died is that he was starting to do movies more as a character actor with his looks. But what he, the rare thing about him is with all of his musical theater chops and what he was able to do, that as an actor, he sort of defined and created this guy who could be a villain and you liked him. And incredibly funny too. He had a wicked sense of humor, that sort of Irish cutting sense of humor, and he infused that in everything he did. I mean, if you look at Peter Falk said that he was largely responsible for the success of Columbo because he was the perfect foil to Peter Falk as Columbo, and he was. He did three of them. He had that wonderful way that he could get away with being the womanizer or being the villain or being the cad, and you still liked him. He was still incredibly charming. Very rare, hard to do.
Did you ever get to work with your dad?
No. Unfortunately, yeah, I was 14, I believe, when he passed. And, you know, by that time, I was, you know, I was still very heavily into sports in high school. I was a drummer and I sang in a band and stuff like that. But I had no aspirations to follow in my family's footsteps. I really thought I was going to be a quarterback in, you know, college and maybe the NFL, not to be. But yeah, that was my, so I didn't.
Well, I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb here. When you were playing Julian Marsh in 42nd Street, which I had the great pleasure of seeing, was there a little part of you that was channeling your dad?
I think, yeah. I mean, 100%. I was going to say, I think I did that in many roles. You know, I've gotten to do two of the roles he did. I did Max Mencken in It's a Bird That's Playing Superman. I also got to do Stephen Kadai in She Loves Me. And each time, and even when I've done Harold Hill, and I've done it five times, I always take him, a piece of him. I mean, it's me. I infuse me. And but with Julian, I watched Warner Baxter, and he had that sort of 30s thing. He sort of talked like this, kind of really fast. And I kind of wanted that because I thought it was really for the period. So I worked on that. But my father had a lot of that naturally. He was that kind of actor. And again, I think as I grew up, and I had many of his mannerisms anyway. I mean, everybody ever always said to me that when I was on the stage, oh my God, you look so much like your father. In person, I think I have a lot of my mother too, but on the stage, and of course, when my hair went white, even more so. But yeah, I constantly looked to him as a sort of a template for many of the parts I did. And Julian, I remember the first day I walked out in costume, and I had my hair, and I had a little bit of, they added a little piece here, which was sort of a 30s flip to it. And I walked out in the sort of three-piece suit that was kind of pinstripe, and my mother saw me. It took her breath away. She literally thought she was looking at my father, and I was. So you know, much of my, I remember the opening like monologue was, "All right, everybody, gather around and listen to me." And he was sort of like, you know, my father kind of talked like that. And he had, and with, you know, a vicious smile. And one review said that in Fade Out, Fade In, that Jack Cassidy's teeth were dancing across the stage. Well, I like to think that maybe I did at times too, or mine did at times.
Well, I'm glad you confirmed what my sense was. I was a big fan of your dad's, both your parents. While we're talking about your family, Patrick, you got to co-star with your brother, David, in a very entertaining TV sitcom called Ruby and the Rockets, created by your brother, Sean, and featuring a very young Austin Butler. Mm-hmm. The show got some really good reviews. It was a great family show. Were you surprised when they didn't renew it after the first season?
Very surprised. Actually, heartbroken. It was probably one of the greatest gifts in my career to do because of what you said, Sean. Ran the show. He's such a great writer, producer, getting to obviously act opposite David. And, you know, much of it was kind of loosely based on things in our lives. I mean, David and I weren't a band like Hall & Oates, although we looked like Flock of Seagulls, but it's about two brothers and one that goes on, you know, after they break up, and one that, you know, marries a video dancer. And that's my wife. She did movies and videos and stuff, had two boys, which was documented. And then of course, Katie Cassidy, who's David's daughter, you know, showed up at 11 years old and said, so that was kind of like the basis of the show. But, you know, getting to do it every day. Austin was brilliant in the show. He was only 17. He was so good. And then my mom did an episode. My brother Ryan, who's worked behind the scenes for years and years and years, was in set decoration. He did the show. My wife choreographed on the show. So it was really a family affair. And I remember being on the CBS Radford lot. Every time I walked into stage 12, I put my hand on the 12 and I just thanked God for being able to do that. It was short-lived. It was funny and it was really well done. I think we were on the wrong network. ABC Family had never done a sitcom before. You know, they were known more for sort of dramedies and one-camera film shows, and this was in front of a live audience. So I don't think they really had a lead-in for it or something to follow it, and I don't think they were sure how to promote it. So, but it was an incredible experience.
It really was, and I was very disappointed as well, as I loved the show. You starred in another really fun TV series called Dirty Dancing, based on the movie, and you played the Patrick Swayze character. They canceled that show after only 11 episodes. So I've always wanted to ask you, do you think the network gave the show enough of a chance to find its audience?
That's a great question. I would say probably not. I mean, I think they, you know, there were big shoes to fill, huge dance shoes for me to fill in that Patrick Swayze, obviously. And I wasn't a dancer. I mean, I was an athlete and I knew how to move pretty well. And I had done Leader of the Pack and had the genius of Michael Peters as like my dance teacher / choreographer. So he put me with great people. So I'd had that experience. But I went into, you know, pre-production rehearsals for, I would say, 2.5 months with Kenny Ortega as, again, my personal teacher. I was so blessed with that. But I think, you know, we were obviously very compared to the movie. When I look at it, and I've watched episodes afterwards, I've showed my kids, I think Kenny actually took the dance element and he built on it because he had those 11 episodes to, you know, flesh it out even more. I was so proud of what we produced. I don't know ultimately if it just worked on a weekly basis. And again, the success of the film, I mean, it made Jennifer Grey a star, Patrick Swayze a huge star. You know, it's very hard to live up to that in a television series, you know. So I think they probably thought it was going to be an immediate success. And if it wasn't, and it was an expensive show to do at the time.
Well, I think it was ahead of its time. And I think shows like Glee proved that there was a market. I don't think they gave it enough of a chance. That's my opinion. Mm-hmm. Now, Patrick, you've had a truly marvelous career in musical theater. As I mentioned in my introduction, your very first Broadway show was The Pirates of Penzance. You were not even out of high school a year when you did the national tour for 3 months before going to Broadway. You got to work with some great performers like Treat Williams, Maureen McGovern, Kay Ballard, George Rose. Was it intimidating to be on the stage with these people so early in your career?
It should have been. And in the sense that when you say it now, I go, oh my God, that's intimidating. At the time, I think I was naive enough to go, I'm just throwing myself into this. I mean, I was not ready for the part in the sense that I hadn't studied enough acting. I had a nice pop voice that was very right for that, following Rex Smith, who, you know, that was how he saw so that. And I was totally Frederick. I was a juvenile of nobleness and honesty and naivete. And Wilfred saw that in the audition, and that's why he cast me. So basically, that is what I think, you know, didn't get in the way of me getting nervous, the fact that I was working with these iconic theater actors and brilliant. And they taught me. When I went to New York and I was there for a year doing Pirates, I always viewed that as that was my college, because I was studying at HB Studios in the daytime twice a week, three times a week. And then doing a show at night with, like you said, the likes of Treat Williams and Kay Ballard, and who was a very good friend of my father's. And so they taught me. You know, I remember George Rose, who was iconic as Shakespearean actor, you know, he said to me at one point, I was sort of backing up on stage, you know, as we were doing a two-character scene. Well, that's called upstaging an actor. And I didn't know that. I was just sort of like, you know, maybe nervously backing up, and said, and he would back up even further. And I didn't understand. Well, by the time, you know, we got to sort of the back of the set. And so after the performance, he said, darling, don't upstage me anymore because it won't work. And that's when I learned, oh, that's upstaging. Okay. Mm-hmm. There was my first lesson. And then, of course, many things after that with everybody. They all were teachers to me. And so after that stint in New York, that's what launched me into wanting to be really serious as an actor. I took my craft very seriously. That's the other thing I think that put me on the right road is that I really wanted to be good at my craft. That meant more to me than anything. Definitely meant more to me than any of the star thing. I never cared about that. I just wanted to be taken seriously and respected for what I did. And I think that also came from going into the business and having those gigantic shoes to fill, you know, following my parents and following my brothers. And so that became the most important thing. And you know, I think to a large degree, I managed to do that.
To an enormous degree, you managed to do that. So your parents told you basically not to go into the business for the reasons you told us. Was there ever a moment when both of them said to you, you're really good, you really do have a career, you do belong in this business, you did the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously my father wasn't around too, and he didn't get to see what I had done, but my mother did, all the time. And I feel very blessed. I got to spend a lot more time with my mother than both my brothers, simply because we worked together so much on the road. And I mean, we did the Music Man together 3 times with her playing Mrs. Peru. And like I said, our act, our cabaret act. But yeah, she was incredibly proud of what I had done. And as I said, she said, you did it the right way. You learned your craft, you worked on your craft, you established yourself in the theater. You know, in those days, it was 1981, you know, if you were known as a New York actor, the television and film business in Los Angeles really like, oh my God, he's a New York actor. And that gave me my launch, you know, into being successful. So when I came back to Los Angeles, which was my home, that's where I lived. I always had a California driver's license. People were like, oh, he's a New York actor. So yeah, that felt great.
Back in the 80s, you starred in one of the very first jukebox musicals called Leader of the Pack, which you've mentioned. It's based on the life and music of the singer-songwriter Ellie Greenwich. What do you think of jukebox musicals, Patrick?
I think they can be big-time moneymakers. I think that they're very difficult to pull off and be successful and being taken seriously. I think the best of all of them is Jersey Boys, in terms of how it's put together. I mean, it's a difficult thing to do because you're taking an existing catalog and putting a story to it. And in most musicals, as we know, you know, the music and the lyrics extends the story. People, you know, are doing a dialogue scene. Well, they get to the point where they sing. Well, now we're moving on with the story through the song. But with, you know, existing songs, and many of them pop songs in these catalogs, they don't do that as well. I mean, they do it in Mamma Mia. And I did Mamma Mia. And, you know, it's very light. It's not deep. I think Jersey Boys is the best of it. I think that Leader of the Pack, the reason, I mean, we did not get great reviews, but, you know, that was indicative of the beginning of it, of going, well, these songs really don't propel the story forward. They're great songs and familiar. And then, you know, we had the real Ellie Greenwich come on the stage for the last 5 songs. I mean, it was an incredible cast. Darlene Love was in it. You know, I played opposite Diana Manoff, and it was the first. I think Buddy opened a few months after we did, and Buddy got hailed. So that was the first, you know, success of that. I think it's a very hard thing to do. I think that there are some catalogs, writers, where maybe the music and lyrics themselves lend itself more to that. I think Billy Joel. I think if Elton ever used actually his catalog of music, because the lyrics are so dense, Bernie's lyrics are so dense, I think that could lend more to it. And I think as a writer, if you're able to take the lyrics and use, say, characters in those songs out of the lyrics, you'd be able to weave those songs in through the story that would actually do the same as if you wrote an original score for it. But it would take somebody that really knows how to do that.
You know, when I was looking at your career, one thing that's really very unusual about you is that you've never really been a New York actor because your residence was always in California. But look at all the Broadway shows you've starred in. So you really got to be a New York actor. Don't you think that's just amazing?
Amazing. I was the bi-coastal actor. I don't know if you can do that today. I would rent my house in California or have somebody stay there. I'd go to New York anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half each show. Yet I must have sublet 7, 8, 9 apartments over the course of, you know, almost 40 years. And yeah, I had this, and what was so wonderful about it is I'd go do a show, come to LA. All of a sudden I was, you know, back in LA. So I was the hot, you know, person for auditions and pilots and miniseries and all that stuff. And then if my pilot didn't get picked up or whatever, back to New York. And that doesn't happen. It's a very rare thing for that to happen. Never had a set residence in New York, always California. So yeah, I felt very lucky. I talk about that all the time about, you know, that was a blessing. Not many people can get that.
Do you have a favorite role of all the parts you've played in the theater?
Harold Hill.
Harold Hill, the music man.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you know this. I'm sure you have because you do such wonderful research on people. But, you know, I was conceived on that movie.
Yes, I heard you actually punched your mother's co-star from from In Utero.
I think it was a kick, but yeah, he felt a thump on the footbridge scene, stopped the take, and said, "What the heck is that?" Because he didn't know, and she said, "That's Patrick Cassidy." And then, of course, 20 years later, I was doing Night of 100 Stars in New York, and he was there, Robert Preston. And I went to his dressing room and I knocked on the door, and the door opened, and I said, "Excuse me, Mr. Preston, I have to introduce myself. My name is Patrick Cassidy." And he smiled and he stepped back and he said, "Thank you, we've already met." That's a true story. So getting to do the part, and also, you know, I talk about this a lot. When I broke my collarbone in high school, I was a quarterback and thought I was going to literally go to colleges and do all that. The drama department was doing The Music Man. And I thought, well, heck, I'm perfect to play Harold Hill. Mom was marrying the librarian in the movie. So my mom called up Dick Van Dyke, and I went to Dick Van Dyke's house. I was 16. And Dick Van Dyke taught me, "You got trouble in River City." And he said, "Patrick, go in. You're going to be great. You're going to make a great Harold Hill." And I went in, sang, had a hat and a cane, and I got the part of salesman number 5. And I fell in love with it. That's when I got bit by the theater bug. It literally changed the whole trajectory of my career.
Breaking your collarbone.
Yeah. And Michael Lawrence, who, God rest his soul, he's gone now, but he's Stephen E.D. Gourmet's son, Steve Lawrence and E.D. Gourmet, he got it. And yeah, that show, and then I've gotten to play Harold 4 times. I got to direct it. I got to produce it at my first artistic director job in California. So yeah, it's very close to my heart, and the part is.
Well, this is an odd thing to say, that I'm glad you broke your collarbone when you were in college, but it really was a fortuitous thing because that directed you away from athletics and into the theater. Do you have a preference as between performing on stage versus acting on TV or in the movies?
Yeah, I mean, I probably follow this with a lot of other performers. I mean, the theater is an incredible way to build your craft. It also is, you know, the immediate response, obviously. And it is an actor's medium, in that after the rehearsal process and the director goes away, you drive the ship. It's you every night from beginning to middle end. And what really hones your chops as an actor is doing it 8 shows a week. Because if it doesn't work, you get to try things out in front of an audience. I mean, it's basically the same show, but you're gonna try something new. Well, that didn't work. Why don't we try this? So if you make mistakes, you get a chance the very next performance to better it, right? Whereas film and television, we know, is a director's meeting. You shoot out a sequence, you wait around a lot, and they put your performance together in the editing room, or they break your performance. So in that way, I prefer the theater. I love film. I love the process of it. It is truly different, in that, you know, you do it out of order and you do sections and things like that. But if I was to say, which one would you rather do? Probably the theater. Although it's 8 shows a week. I always said doing it on musical 8 shows a week, you're an Olympic athlete in training.
Yeah, so it's a good thing you started out as an athlete. Now, Patrick, of course, I have to ask you about your incredibly moving performance as Howard, a closeted gay actor who eventually gets AIDS in the landmark Oscar-nominated movie Longtime Companion. The film was such a masterpiece. The scene between you and John Dossett in the hospital room was so heart-wrenching that honestly, it was almost unbearable. Is that one of your favorite roles on screen?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, you as an actor wish, pray that you get roles that are, that really you get to, sink your teeth into and parts you get to play. But this was something else. This was groundbreaking. This was a chance to do something that no one else had done. And frankly, what goes along with that is fear. I mean, definitely at that time, I know that there were a lot of stars that were offered that movie. That turned it down simply because they were afraid of what playing a gay character at that time, also about the AIDS epidemic, what that would do to them. But Mary Louise Parker's in it, and Dermot Mulroney's in it, and Bruce Davison got nominated for the Academy Award, and I was honored to do it. Did it hurt my career afterwards? Maybe. I don't know. I went on to do a lot more work, but in terms of what we did and the attention, I remember after it opened. I went to like a couple parties, and people like Sean Penn and Robert Downey Jr. grabbed me and hugged me and thanked me. John Schlesinger, the director, same thing. So the effect it had on the industry, and again, the breaking of new ground, I think it paved the way for movies like Philadelphia that got made. Norman Ray, God rest his soul, he died of AIDS. He directed it beautifully, and Craig Lucas wrote an incredible script, and so proud of it. So proud of it. Yeah.
Well, we had Harry Hamlin on the show who played a gay character in Making Love. He said that he felt that playing a gay character did affect his career and he didn't care. We had Bruce Davison on the show, your co-star in Longtime Companion. He didn't feel that it did affect his career. And he said, even if it did, he was so proud that he made that movie. And I'm so glad to hear you basically say the same thing because for those of us who are gay and who lived through that era, that movie was so powerful and it validated our relationships and it created empathy in a world that was not very empathetic towards people with HIV. And so it's great to be able to thank you publicly for participating in that project because you really did change the landscape of how the rest of the world saw not only HIV and AIDS, but gay people. So thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It was my honor. So many of my friends, look, I lost a lot of my friends, a lot of incredibly talented, creative artists. I was in New York from 1981 to 1986, almost straight. And I mean, that's when it just was at its full tilt. And I mean, it was incredibly important to me. And when COVID happened, it was interesting, my take on COVID. I didn't have any of the fear that so many people had on this epidemic that had happened and pandemic that happened. And I think it was because, well, I was there in New York City in 1981 and 1982. And when AIDS, was starting to get flushed out and what it was a death sentence. If you were HIV positive in those beginning, it was a death. I saw a 25-year-old dancer who was in Leader of the Pack, who he got diagnosed in 3 weeks, he was gone. And so it was, and you didn't know how you contracted it. We didn't know if it was from a toilet seat or, there was so many like things going around in those early stages of it. So when COVID happened, and no disrespect, I have tremendous empathy. I had COVID pretty bad at one point. I didn't have the fear of getting it. I didn't have the fear because I had seen a true pandemic that was a killer, and it was,
Was pretty bad. Another very powerful TV miniseries you made, which earned you an Emmy Award nomination, was called Dress Grey, co-starring Eddie Albert, Alec Baldwin, and Lloyd Bridges, where you play a closeted gay cadet at a military academy who was murdered. That was a very intense story and so very, very well made. Is that show one of your favorites as well?
Oh, sure. I mean, as you said, the cast I got to work with. I got to be very good friends with Alec at the time, and we shot it in Roswell, New Mexico, at a military academy. And Gore Vidal wrote the script. He wrote the screenplay, and it was and he was such an interesting guy. I remember him saying to me, he goes, I don't believe there's ever been a character like this, David Hand. And he was saying because he David thought of himself as perfect in every way. He thought he was perfect. And that is a very interesting thing to think about and play as an actor. What does that mean? How does that come across? And yet he had, his thing was, sex for him was about power. And at this military academy that they try to cover up and all that stuff. But yeah, we had again, great cast to work with, great director, Glenn Jordan. And that I remember training at the military academy for 3 weeks to learn all, the stuff and how to be a cadet.
Another really important movie you made in 1981 was called Angel Dusted, starring Jean Stapleton and her son John Putch, dealing with the dangers of drug addiction among young people. Given the opioid epidemic that's happening today, that movie, in my opinion, was very, very much ahead of its time and still so relevant and current, don't you think?
Oh, sure. I never thought about that. It's a great question. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was very early in my career. I think I was what might have been my second or third television job. And yeah, I mean, what's happened, with the opioid epidemic is beyond tragic. I mean, we're talking synthetic heroin that people are taking. No wonder, it became massive across the country. And they were it was being given out easily. There's obviously been many television shows and movies about it. And yeah, I mean, when I look back at that time and the drug culture, which was very early, especially that, yeah, very significant.
Were you ever tempted to get into heavy drinking or drugs?
My father was an alcoholic, and my brother David basically died of alcoholism. And so it was very prevalent in our family, and I have uncles and cousins, so I was afraid of it. I think also because I was a athlete, I was very into staying in shape. I also had, I had to take off my shirt a lot in different roles. Joseph, obviously, the Egyptian thing, Aida. So I was constantly trying to eat really great and watch calories and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I'm very aware that alcoholism runs in my family, and I try to really, stay on top of that because, look, it can happen to anyone. It really can. I mean, the opioid thing is proof, and that becomes a physical addicted drug, not over a long-term use. It's very short-term that it can happen to somebody. So I'm very aware of it and stay vigilant about it.
Well, I'm very proud of you that you never fell into the trap that a lot of Hollywood kids did. Maybe it's because being athletic and being good looking and needing to disrobe in front of the audience was a good motivator, but it worked. Now, you dealt with another addiction in 1985. You made a great movie about gambling addictions called Fever Pitch, co-starring Ryan O'Neal, whom we recently lost. I understand you maintained a friendship with Ryan O'Neal for many years.
Yeah, although there was a blemish on it. I've been told this story a long time. First of all, it was directed by Richard Brooks, who had directed Elmer Gantry with my mother and in Cold Blood, Blackboard Jungle. And Richard was a DI in the Marine Corps, drill instructor. And he ran the set like that, screamed at everyone. So intimidating. I mean, intimidating. And he didn't let anyone but the star, Ryan, the script supervisor, producer, read the script. So you, as an actor, you got just your pages. And it was scary on that set. Ryan, I had met prior to getting the movie. He worked out at my gym, the same gym that I worked out. And so I knew him, and he was dating Farrah at that time. And Ryan, God bless him, he was an incredible guy. But he was incredibly competitive. I mean, and I'm competitive too, athlete, the whole sports thing. So one day we were on the set in Las Vegas. We shot it. And he said to me, I hear you play racquetball. And I said, yeah, I do. He said, we got to play. Well, what he didn't know was I literally, in my time off, played racquetball every day for 2 to 3 hours a day. I went on the circuit. You know, I played in the A division. I was really good. And he had a racquetball, I think, court in his house or something. Anyway, so we go and we play. Farrah's sitting upstairs watching. And the first ball that comes off the back wall, I go to hit it like this, and he's standing right there. And I pulled back, and I had nicked his hand. Now, in racquetball, you have to give way to the other person. But he was standing like this. He wasn't even aware of me. And I nicked his hand, and he went ballistic on me. Literally, you know, I mean, he was so, like, I was like, wow. And I thought, you know, and I said, well, Brian, you're right in the way. And So I ended up playing the game. I think we played two games, and I shot all around him. And like I said, because I played a lot, I was very good. And I ended up beating him both games. Well, he shook my hand, left. He didn't talk to me for the rest of the 2.5 weeks I was there.
You can't be serious.
Now, he was a bit of a, or at least that day, a bit of a sore loser. And then finally, he called me and said, I want to apologize to you. I was totally out of line that day. And I'm so sorry. And we were good friends ever since. And I'd see him up. He was incredibly kind to me. Always, always, always. But that was the moment that I'd forgotten about. It was a moment in two actors going at it on a racquetball court.
Well, it makes you wonder what Farrah Fawcett must have gone through, to be honest.
Yeah, who knows?
Well, let me ask you about another diva. In 1986, you made a TV movie called Christmas Eve with the legendary Loretta Young. What was she like to work with?
Well, again, I worked with so many people, Harvey, that at the time I didn't know who they were in the sense that what they had achieved in their careers. And she was definitely one. So Ron Liebman, incredible actor, was on the show with me. And I was probably 23, 24 years old. And the first day of rehearsal, he called me over and he said, hey, Patrick, do you know who Loretta Young is? And I said, no, not really. He says, let me tell you, one of the most beautiful faces to ever grace a screen. And in the 50s, she had her own show called The Loretta Young Show. She'd come down this sweeping staircase and this beautiful drop said, and I'm sitting and listening to him very, she was a devout Catholic. And she had, I don't know if you've heard this story before, I think Stephen Sondheim told this story. She had a swear box on the set that any member of the crew who swore had to pay increments of money depending on what they said. If they said, you know, damn, it was a quarter. If they said shit, it was 50 cents. But if she used the Lord's name in vain, it was a dollar. So apparently, I've heard it was Celeste Holm. I've heard it was Ethel Merman. I've heard different people. I heard it was Celeste Holm. Anyway, apparently she was going over lines and she goes, oh, God damn it, I'll never get this line there. Loretta heard her, got the box, brought it over. And she said, Celeste, it's going to cost you $1. And Celeste reached into her handbag and she took out a five and she said, here, Loretta, go fuck yourself. And so that was my opening monologue from Ron about who she was. And she was a joy. And I was in awe of her and found out, of course, later in my career. And there were many examples of that, Harvey. Later in my career, I realized just who I had gotten to perform with. I mean, I'll tell you one, when I did Napoleon and Josephine, I was in love, crush with Jacqueline Bisset. Crush.
What a surprise.
Yeah, exactly. If anybody ever saw The Deep in the first 5 minutes of that movie, when she comes out of the ocean in a white t-shirt, forget it. And you're a young, you know, 13-year-old boy. I was just like, and then getting to play her lover and getting to have a romantic scene that ends with a kiss. I was like, oh my God. And I worked at Tuesday Well, same thing. With a 42-year-old in love with a 22-year-old. And Ellen Burstyn played my mom. I mean, these were the kind of people early in my career that I got to work with and had the privilege and got to learn from. And And yes, I knew who some of them were, but I didn't know, you know, to the degree of their success and just what sort of iconic work they had done. And yeah.
Well, for all those movie buffs out there, just in case you don't know, the movie that Patrick just referred to is from 1986. It's called Something in Common. And it starred Ellen Burstyn, who played Patrick's mother. She was very unhappy that Patrick was dating an older woman, played by Tuesday Weld. And you mentioned Jacqueline Bisset. That's from the 1987 TV miniseries Napoleon and Josephine, A Love Story, co-starring Armand Assante. You played her lover, Hippolyte Charles, Jacqueline Bisset's lover. How did you go about preparing to play a real person? Because he really existed.
Yeah, I mean, I did as much research as I could at that time. Obviously, we didn't have access to internet or anything, but I did as much research as I can. They spent a lot of money on it. I mean, wow, the costumes and the hair and everything. And we shot it in France. I mean, it was a gift. I'm in France for 10 weeks shooting this incredible miniseries. I mean, Anthony Perkins was in it. Again, didn't know who he was. Didn't know who this iconic actor person was at the time. So kind to me. An array of unbelievable British actors. And again, getting to work with one of my major, you know, teenage crushes. Armand was very intense New York actor, prepared, actor's studio method, you know, yelling at himself in the mirror to get himself enraged and stuff before scenes. He was, but, you know, and we shot at these incredible, incredible chateaus all over Paris and France. So it was a dream come true. And I was in the middle of, you know, again, so much of my career, Harvey, even as we're talking about that, was school for me, because I didn't go to college. And because I wanted to be so good and taken seriously, that each job, specifically in those first 10 years, was literally another class for me to get, you know, learn another aspect of myself as an actor. I got to study with Lise Strasberg when I was 17. I got to study with Stella Adler. And then, of course, Larry Moss, who also became sort of a pioneer as an acting teacher, became my mentor. I came up at a time when that was available to me. And because of my parents, I also had knowledge of the time before me and the people before me.
Well, some of the people. We now find out that you didn't know who some of these people were, but I'm going to mention a name that I would be shocked if you tell me you didn't know who she was. From 1993, you co-starred with her in a Los Angeles production of the Stephen Sondheim musical Company, Carol Burnett. Now, you did know who she was.
Beyond. Well, first of all, she was an incredible friend of my father. So I knew Carol, and I saw Carol at my house, and she would come over and stuff like that.
And what was she like to work with?
Oh, unbelievable. She, okay, I'm going to tell you another quick little story. So my father did a movie with Bette Davis and Ernest Borgnine called Bunny O'Hare. They played the sort of grandmother, grandfather of bank robbers, and he was like the bumbling cop trying to figure out who did it.
Is that the movie when Bette Davis wore an eye patch?
I think so. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember they did all their getaways and they had costumes or you know, to cover up when they'd rob banks, and they got away on a motorcycle. But in the first day of rehearsal, my father, who was in awe of Bette Davis, wanted to break the ice. And again, like I said earlier, my father had the ability to be very charming and yet could be almost caddish. And so he thought, but he had a great sense of humor and he could get away with a lot of things that a lot of other men wouldn't have been able to. So he went up to her, he thought to break the ice, he was gonna be funny. And he went up to her and he says, "Betty, you've got one good schnup in your left and I want it."
That's what you call having a devilish charm.
That's right. So she laughed, they were great friends, went on. Well, I told this story in rehearsals for Company to Carol, because we had talked about my father and Fade Out, Fade In that they had done together and all this stuff, right? And she fell over, right? So a week into the rehearsal process, I went up to her and I said, "Carol, you've got one good shtup in your left and I want it." And she turned on me and she said, 10,000.
What, she had 10,000 stups left, or she wanted 10,000?
That's exactly what she was referring to.
You know, I'll tell you something. If your career has been one big learning experience, my friend, you've got a master's degree.
Oh,
that's for sure. Another movie I loved, Santa Boot Camp, was with Rita Moreno. Did you get to know her at all?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it was very recently. I mean, like, it was actually the last sort of television thing I did. And I really want to talk about Studio 10 because it has been an unbelievable thing at this point.
We'll get there, I promise.
But, yeah, I did it here in Nashville. It was a sort of a Hallmark movie, yeah, or I think so. Anyway, and yeah, I had met Rita once. I take that back. She was performing at the Regency Hotel in New York, and my mother was the next one after that, and we saw Rita's show and I met her. She was great. So when this happened, they called me and they said, you know, Patrick, would you do this? It was only, I think, 3 days or 4 days of work. And I said, sure. I had off. I wasn't directing or producing a show. So I went, and she couldn't have been lovelier. So wonderful. And John Shuck, who lives here, also, he was in the movie, and she was just wonderful. Took a bunch of photos. Marissa Walker, who's, you know, won the Tony Award for Hairspray, she was in it too. It was great. She was lovely, really lovely.
You know, your family has become a multi-generational presence in the entertainment world. First, there were your parents. Then there's you and your brothers. Now there's the next generation, which includes your niece, Katie, David's daughter, and your son, Cole, and your son, Jack, who appeared on The Voice in 2017. And he's released a beautiful song called Song of Victory. You must be so proud.
Oh, they're great. But they're here now, too. Jack lives in Nashville. In fact, that's the reason why my wife and I came out here. It's a miracle. And it's an incredible story how we got here. And my son, Cole, who's actually here in town, he arrived a couple of days ago. He lives in California. He did it right, Harvey, my son Cole. He did what my mother wanted all of us to do, in that we pushed them. You asked about, you know, how my mom and my dad were with us. Well, I made it very clear the same way with my kids. You got to get a degree. Go to college. If you want to do the show business thing, have something to fall back in. All that stuff. Well, he did do it right. He got a mechanical engineering degree and is a great guitar player, great singer. He travels with my brother Sean when Sean goes on the road. He just got $1 million quartet to play Carl Perkins. He's going to do the Norwegian thing, but he has this incredible job of stability as a project manager. And so, I'm so proud of both of them. They're great singers. And Jack is an incredible songwriter.
Were you in favor of Jack auditioning for The Voice?
You know, I think I had my worry, as my mother did, or any parent where their child goes into this business in any way, of what it's going to do. You know, it's a hard business. And as talented as he is, I will say the one thing about Jack and his music talent is you look at his talent and you go, yeah, he's right for this business. He's got it. Now that it, we know, no matter how good you are, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to become famous or that you're going to be successful. Because it's the only business, and I say this all the time when I teach. I'll teach at colleges, do major drama programs, and I'll say to them all, I said, you know, here's the reality. Let's start with this. 90% of you won't be doing this in 10 years. And that's a fact. It's very, no matter how talented you are, it's the only business where you can be the best as a singer, as a dancer, as an actor, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to work. Yes, you up your percentage and chances to do it, but it doesn't. It's whereas if you're the best carpenter, you're going to work. If you're the best bricklayer or store manager or whatever else you do, you're going to work at that skill. It's different as an actor because there's so many other things that it hinges on in terms of you getting a part, right?
I think it's even more brutal than that, because even if you are the best, look at your brothers, David and Sean. They became overnight superstars as teenagers. They had so much pressure to deal with. In my opinion, that's like having too much too soon. I'm very glad that you didn't go into pop music as a young man. You chose to go into musical theater because you had way, your trajectory of your career was healthier. Does that make sense?
100%. Oh, no, you're 100% right. It was a choice. Best choice I ever made. Best choice I ever made was you know, ignore the record companies, Robert Stigwood, RSO, Warner Brothers, Mike Curb, all that, saying, hey, we want to make you the next Cassidy, blah, blah, here's a lot of money, blah. And it was that moment, I was 17, and I had a good manager that said, look, it's not sustainable. And if you do that, and maybe you'll make $1 million or come in, right? But it's over. And I saw it with my brothers. And it was that choice of going, I'm going to go this route to try to get credibility, be taken seriously, that has given me the longevity that I was blessed to have for 4 years as a performer.
Well, you know, it's very clear to me that your major ambition throughout your career was not necessarily to be a household name, but as you said, to be taken seriously, respected as an actor and a performer. Patrick, were there times in the beginning when people in the industry had preconceptions about you because of who your parents were and what your brothers were doing?
Oh, 150%. I mean, in fact, I think the first 10 years of my career, I wasn't really taken seriously. I worked and I made a living, actually. A lot of television that time. In the first 10 years, I think I did two of the Broadway shows I got to do. But it was, and in that time, like I said, I was learning. I got better. I wasn't good in the beginning. I worked at it. I really wanted to be good. And I kept working. But it wasn't until I did Assassins. When I did Assassins, this thing at Playwrights Horizons, tiny little 133-seat theater, right? But I was originating a Stephen Sondheim show. I mean, it's every actor's dream, wish to be able to do that. With Jerry Zaks, who was the number one director at the time in New York, and Paul Gimignani, and John Wideman, who wrote an incredible book to that show. I was working with those people. And when it happened, and we did it, and very few people saw it because it didn't move to Broadway, but the elite of New York saw it. And then, of course, the album became a smash. To this day, people say, I hear your voice singing the Ballad of Booth all the time. I grew up, I went to college, I listened to that, I played that album until it was warped and all that stuff. But it was then that I think people saw me and say, oh, he is not just a Cassidy, he is a respected actor and he has earned his way. But yeah, I had to battle with that, of course, in the first 10 years, because so much of anybody in the business is looking at me and going, okay, show me. Just because your last name is Cassidy, you know, that doesn't mean anything. You got to do it. But the one thing I will say about that, because there are a lot of brothers of, or sons of, daughters of, you might get that shot to do one thing or two things maybe, but to sustain a career, it's you on the screen. It's you up on the stage. It's not your parent or your brother or your what. It's you. And if they keep giving you work, well, you must be doing something right, you know? And I managed to do that.
Tenfold, 100-fold. You mentioned Assassins. I'd like to point out that you played the balladeer in New York, but if I'm not mistaken, you also played John Wilkes Booth in LA in the same show. Mm-hmm. So yes, versatility is your name. Now, you are the artistic director at the Studio 10 Theater Company in Franklin, Tennessee. Last fall, you directed the Million Dollar Quartet, which was a huge success. Mm-hmm. How do you like the job?
Oh, it's unbelievable. You know, and I say this now all the time, I had the blessing of having a long career as a performer, 40 years, right? And in the last 12, 14, 13 years, I slowly started to transition into teaching, which transitioned into directing, which transitioned into producing. And you know, I was at the Wynn Hotel in Vegas overseeing as the resident director of the big Showstoppers show, and as an acting teacher on La Rev, and that was 3 years. I produced a show that my brother wrote for my mother and I called Have You Met Miss Jones. It was an autobiographical musical about her life. And like I said, the music man at the Kennedy Center getting to direct and at the Heinz Hall. And then, of course, working at colleges and teaching for as a guest teacher for semesters and directing shows. And I just started sort of, you know, combining and putting this career together on the other side. And I don't miss acting at all. If I do it, it will be a very rare circumstance. I get to direct. I get to cast, I get to plan shows. We just put together our next season. What has happened here in Tennessee with Studio 10 is unbelievable. And I don't know if you know about this, but during the pandemic, I came here, just I'll say quickly, my son had gotten a record deal and a publishing deal. I had never been to Tennessee. I came out, I drove him out here from California, fell in love with what I saw. My wife and I had wanted to get out of California for over a decade. And I loved it here. And Melissa, my wife, said the same thing. She said, honey, I could move there. And I said, well, what's the theater business like here? And one of Jack's best friend's mom was a volunteer usher for this equity theater company called Studio 10. And they had listed an interim artistic director. So I called from my office. I'd had my first artistic director job at Five Star Theatricals in Thousand Oaks. I've been running it for about 18 months. And I called and I said, my name is Patrick Cassidy. I'd like to come see your production of Mamma Mia. I came out. I saw it. I took the managing director, Todd Morgan, to lunch the next day, and I said, I'd like to put my name in the hat for this. I think he thought I was kidding. That started a long conversation with the board chair for 3 months. Anyway, I got it. And they gave me a 2-year pay or play deal to come out. Sold my house, came out, didn't know how I was going to like it. And in that 2 years, I got here in November of 19. Well, we know what happened in March of 20. And they spent the next 2 years again learning about the company, where it needed to go, where it was, about this, about the county, about Franklin, about the history of Studio 10, all of it, made friends with all the heads of all the other arts institutes here and actors and so on and so forth. And in the process, created a show very much like this that I'd love you to go watch. It's called Studio 10 Talks. And I was you. I never hosted anything in my life. And I got all my friends, Audra McDonald, Nathan Lane, Kristen Chenoweth, Patti LuPone, Kelly O'Hara, Harvey Fierstein, it goes on. You can't believe the list of people. Victor Garber, everybody to come on the show. And they all did this. And in that, I opened the brand of Studio 10 in New York, in California. And the biggest thing was on the 30-year anniversary of Assassins. I got the entire cast and the director and Paul Gimignani, the great musical director, and John Wideman and Stephen Sondheim to do it. It's a classic. It will forever go down as one of my biggest accomplishments. I'm prouder of that show, Harvey, than anything else I've done in my career, or as proud. And now we, after our first season in our brand new theater that opened in October, and we just had our big donor party last night. We're closing Cabaret this Sunday. All four shows, huge hits at a time when regional theaters are dying. I mean, it has exceeded all of my expectations. I am so happy doing what I get to do and with incredible talent here in Tennessee. So, yeah.
I'm just so thrilled that you've found something that's so meaningful to you. They are so lucky to have you, Patrick. If nobody's told you that, I'm going to tell you. They're really lucky, not just because of your pedigree, your connections, all these friends that you have that are legends, that are supporting you, but because you've found something so fulfilling. But I am surprised that you don't miss acting. Why is that?
You know, and everybody asks me about it, and I see so many, like there's many people on our staff and they're amazing what they do. They're all performers. Most of them got, you know, BFAs and musical theater or drama, and they're all performers, but they're not working as performers. Because as we said, it takes, there's a variety of other things it takes. Doesn't mean they're bad or not talented. They are, but they're still working in the theater. One's doing box office. The other one's doing development. The other one's, you know, I got to do it all at the highest level you can do it. I got to do theater at the highest level. I got to do television and film at the highest level. I got to do Las Vegas, headlined in Las Vegas. I remember seeing my name and my picture above the MGM Grand Hotel starring in FX. I thought, okay, I've arrived. or on the marquee of the Pantages Theater in LA. I mean, things like that. I got recordings, all, you know, different things in television, sitcoms and dramas and miniseries and the movies of the week back in the day. I mean, I got to do it all. And so that part of me, you know, I think was satisfied. And, you know,
so if a great opportunity came along for a recurring role in a really successful long-running series, which you are ripe for, would you say no? Would you consider it?
I mean, sure, I'd consider it.
Okay, I'm putting the word out.
Okay. Yeah, I'd have to really consider it. I mean, I love my job here. I love what I get to do. And yeah, I mean, we'd see. I mean, I wouldn't want to give this up, at least not now. I'm not saying I'll never go back to. There are a couple parts that the one part that has eluded me, that I really believe I should do and I'd like to do, is Billy Flynn in Chicago. It's a really good part for me. And I haven't had that shot. And possibly if Studio 10 does it, or if they call me from New York and say, Patrick, we'd like you to go in for a few months, that would be fun. So if you want to get that one I'll do. I'll go to New York to do that for a few months.
Okay, I'll be in the front row to see that. Oh, that's for you. Sure. I could so see you doing that. Richard Gere did it in the movie.
Yeah.
No, you would be a perfect. I want to ask you, as you know, your brother David wrote two books, Come On, Get Happy and Could It Be Forever? Your mom wrote a beautiful autobiography in 2013, Shirley Jones, a memoir. You've never written a memoir. Do you think you ever will?
I've been asked so many times. I don't think so. I mean, I can't say no for sure, but I don't think so. I mean, Sean is the writer in this family. He's proven it, obviously, as in television. He's an incredible writer and producer. And I think he's going to write the, not tell all, but he's going to write the real book about our family and the legacy of our family. And he should. He's the one. I mean, obviously, you know, he and I will talk a lot about it, and I'll give my point of view about it. I'm sure he'll you know, infuse that into it too. And my brother Ryan.
How do you think your mom would feel about that?
I think it would be very favorable to her. I think she'd love it. You know, I in my opinion, I don't think either of the two books that David did, or even the two books that my mother did, were really a real inside look on a real honest and human level to what our family is and what it was like for us growing up and our parents and all of that. And I think Sean would be able to tell that story better than anyone. So,
okay, I'm going to try to get him on the show, and then I'm going to try to convince him to do it.
Okay.
And then when he does it, we're going to have him back and we'll promote it.
Great. No, he'll write it. I mean, I know it's in his mind. I know he's been thinking about it and toying with it for a long time. And like I said, he's the most suitable to write it.
Well, Patrick, it's been such a pleasure meeting you and having this opportunity to chat with you about your amazing life and career. I love the fact that you're so happy. You know, you've given us all so many beautiful performances over the years. And now here you are at the prime of your life. You are really fulfilled. You're living in a place you love. You're happy with the way your family, with what everyone's doing. You've got this great, you're putting this theater on the world stage. Mm-hmm. Sorry for the pun. And I'm just so proud of how you've strategized your career. I think you are a Cassidy to be proud of. So thank you.
Harvey, thank you. I feel very blessed. And like I said, it's been a privilege and a wonderful journey. And the journey continues in a different way, but I sure get to, I have such a great time getting to do it. But I thank you. And what a wonderful, I'm going to do the typical, Harvey. Unbelievably prepared, incredible interviewer, what a host, asked things that I had no idea, I'd forgotten about, right? You brought up things in my career. So if that doesn't sound familiar to the other guests you've had on this show, then you haven't been watching this show.
I thank you for that with all my heart. It means the world to me. Thank you for taking the time to do our show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And remember, I'm coming to the opening of your performance in Chicago, and I will be in the front row right next to your mom.
Oh, okay. That sounds great. Let's get Fran and Barry Weissler to say okay, and I'm in.
Our guest has been the wonderful actor, singer, and director, Patrick Cassidy. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XBTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.